History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there, maybe even right next door, that should not go untold. And one thing we've learned over the years is that they don't have to go untold. If we'll take the initiative to ask a few questions and perhaps more importantly, to listen patiently to what some of our more experienced neighbors have to say, we're going to end up with some understanding and perspective that we might not have developed otherwise. Our goal here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to get to know 92-year-old Leonard Blake of Whittier, California, and I'm pretty sure you're going to be touched by the resilient spirit that allowed him to overcome devastating injuries suffered as a teenager off of Okinawa in 1945. This is one of those that's sure to tug on your heartstrings a time or two, but his story is also part of a bigger picture that may open some of our eyes to some details we just weren't aware of. We've heard a fair amount of Merchant Mariners on this program over the years, and one thing you might remember was that statistically, serving in the Merchant Marine was more likely to cost you your life in World War II than serving in the Army, Navy, Marines, Coast Guard, or the Army Air Corps. One out of every 26 Merchant Mariners during that time period was killed in action. That's almost 9,500 of the 243,000 who signed up. More than 700 American cargo ships were lost, and those who were injured or killed while serving in the Merchant Marine were eligible for the Mariner's Medal, but in general, not the Purple Heart, though there are at least 26 documented Merchant Marine recipients of the Purple Heart. As we move along through Leonard Blake's story, I think you're going to understand why I brought that up here at the beginning. We're also going to hear where the name Blake came from, because he wasn't born with it. Leonard was an orphan, and let's start with that. How old were you when you were orphaned?
As a baby. Yeah, I was adopted by an LAPD officer who really just took me in so he could keep his wife busy while he was out fooling around. So he left, walked out on this woman. She was almost blind. And,
oh, man.
And he walked out on her when I was 11 years old.
Were there any other kids in the home?
No, just me.
Just you.
I got a job right away, and I kept working. And I finally decided to... I won when I was 14. Well, I wanted to join the service, and so I tried to get in the Marine Corps and the Navy, and they all kicked me out because I wasn't smart enough to get a phony ID card. and I was 14 years old when I went to work in the shipyards up in San Francisco.
All right.
I hitchhiked up there and got a job in the shipyard at Kaiser Shipyards in Richmond, California. I lived on California. I got a room up in a rooming house, and I used to go down every morning at 4 o'clock in the morning and catch the ferry across to Richmond and go to work. I was a chipper. Tried to get in the Marine Corps and the Navy there and couldn't get in, and so I came back down to Los Angeles, and I was down on 6th and Hill Street, and I went to the Marine Corps and the Navy, and they kicked me out. And I saw a sign that said, "Join the United States Maritime Service. Serve your country." It was on 6th and Hill Street. And I went into the recruiting office, and he said, "Let me see your birth certificate." I said, "Well, here I go again," because I was only 15 years old, and you had to be 16 and a half for the maritime school. And he took my birth certificate, and he looked at it, and he said, "Yep, you're 16 and a half, just like that. I was 15. So that's when I got in the United States Maritime Service.
Let me ask you about, your earliest years as you're a boy. So you're orphaned as an infant. This family takes you in. And I think about kids today, and they all have these smartphones, and they have the whole world at their fingertips.
Yeah.
What was your world like as a boy in Southern California? What were some of the things that you did or saw or experienced?
Didn't do very much. I just went to school as long as I could, and then I finally quit. And I quit school when I was 13 years old, but I had jobs in restaurants and paper routes and stuff like that. I always tried to keep myself going. And the poor little lady that this man left while she was blind almost, and so I didn't want to bother her, and that's when I took off and went to San Francisco. And but when I came back and got in the Maritime, well, I just had a good time.
Let me ask you about, you know, because it seems like everyone I've met who was alive during this time has some kind of memory of December 7th, 1941.
Yeah, you remember that it was publicized over the, you know, Roosevelt was the president, and he gave a sounding speech, and it just made you want to go to war.
But you were very young at the time.
Yeah, I started trying to get in the service when I was 14. And didn't make it until I was 15.
But so here you are in Southern California.
Yeah.
You know, this LAPD officer has adopted you. Then he walks out on the family, so it's you and this blind mother, if I can use that word.
Yeah, she was my mother.
And you get this idea, hey, I'm going to leave and go up and work in the shipyard in the Bay Area. What possessed you to do that?
Oh, I had some friends, cousins and stuff that were working there in the shipyard, so I knew them, but I stayed in a rooming house. They lived up there, too.
And what kind of work were you doing there? Because I know how many ships, you know, Kaiser was pumping out.
Oh, I was chipping the welds on the floor of the whole ship. They called me a chipper.
So you just come through and clean them up?
Yeah.
And were there other kids your age doing that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there were other kids working there.
You know, the other thing I want to make sure I touch on, you know, the years leading up to this, your earliest years, these are the years of the Great Depression.
Yeah, they were. Yeah.
How did you experience that? Were you aware that this wasn't the way it was supposed to be?
Yeah, I was aware of it, but it didn't bother me. I still went to school, you know, and got disgusted with school and quit. But I always worked. I always had side jobs. I had jobs in restaurants. I had sometime that was the only meal I got was I worked in a restaurant one time washing the dishes at noontime. I'd get a meal, and then sometime that was the only meal I had for the whole day.
Mm.
But, yeah, times were tough.
Do you remember as a boy having some dreams, some ambitions that, hey, someday when I grow up, here's what I'm going to accomplish or do with my life?
Oh, yeah. I was the guy that adopted me. I just was, he didn't smoke and he didn't drink, but he was a chaser. And so, but he was my idol. I wanted to be a policeman.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you're 14 when you go up to the Bay Area. You work in the shipyard, so you're helping this war effort. These ships are getting sent overseas.
Yeah.
But that wasn't enough for you. You wanted to do more.
Yeah, I wanted to go in the Marine Corps or the Navy.
And you knew what the age requirement was.
Yeah, it was 17.
But you didn't care.
No, I kept trying. I'd say, hoping they'd pass me through, and they'd say no. And so I finally gave up there and came back down here.
So, and once again, the Navy, the Marines wouldn't take you, but you find with the Maritime Service, the Merchant Marine.
Yeah, the Merchant Marine, yeah.
They look at your birth certificate and say, yeah, fine, we'll pretend you're 16 and a half.
That's it, yeah.
Did you know how dangerous that job could be?
Not really. I just wanted to get into the war effort. I was a hot shell man on a 3-inch 50 forward on the Marianne Livermore.
But that wasn't your first ship.
No.
That was your last ship, but that wasn't your first ship.
My first ship was the SS John Constantine. I made mistakes all the way along. When we pulled into New York Harbor, after we were the only ship that made it, we had three ships leave San Pedro, and they were loaded with 2,700 ton of bombs on each one of them. And we were the only ship that got through to Calcutta with our bomb load.
What happened to the others?
They got sunk. We were the only ship that made it.
Now, when you say that, does that mean you witnessed that? You saw them sinking?
No, I saw the, well, I was on bow watch one night, and I saw a flash of light just completely light up the sky. We were one day apart, three ships that were one day apart as we left. And I saw the sky light up, and I knew it was one of the ships.
Hmm.
But then I'd heard afterwards that the other one had gone to, well, we were in Australia, and, you know, from there we were over to India. And,
well, when you see that flash of light, now, and as I understand it, you're three ships, one day apart, but following the same course to India. So you see that flash of light, you put two and two together, you know what's happening.
Yeah, we know.
And you guys are going to be passing through those same waters.
Yeah.
Does that make you wonder what's going to happen to you?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, you're always waiting for them.
And what were your duties aboard that ship?
I was an able-bodied seaman, and I was a helmsman on the ship. So the captain, when we were, he would let us take our shirts off and our hats, and we were on the flying bridge, which was an open bridge. Mm-hmm. And when I'd steer from there, and then I never realized that I'd get sunburned all the time. And I got burned so bad, they say later I was in the hospital, and they said, "Were you ever in the South Pacific?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "How hot was it?" I said, "I remember it was 134.
Ooh.
And she said, "You get sunburned?" "Yeah." I said, "Well, you were burned so deep that they're never going to get all the cancer out."
Wow.
So at one time, they took my nose off and made another nose for me with this piece that's missing here. So that's how I wound up with that darn thing. It's in pain all the time.
On your ear, you're talking about?
Yeah, my left eye.
And did anybody on the ship know how young you really were?
I don't think so. Because the captain on the first ship I was on, he and the first mate called me in when we reached New York Harbor and wanted me to go to officer's training school. And I was only 16. I said, "No, Captain, I want to go to sea." So that's when I got off that ship and went over to the Marianne Livermore. And when I got back down to, you know, San Pedro, that was my last ship.
Yeah, and I don't want to miss anything on the John Constantine, because I'm just thinking, I mean, here you are, a 15-year-old, and I've got daughters that are 17 and 14, so I kind of, I'm picturing someone, you know, one of their friends doing this, and you're out in a new adventure that I'm sure you've never experienced before.
Oh, yeah, I was having a lot of fun.
Well, what was it like? I mean, that's a long journey from Southern California to India.
Yeah, it was, I enjoyed it. I had a good time on board ship. We went ashore. We had a seaman's club in India,
mm-hmm.
and I used to take the Navy kids. We had an Navy armed guard,
right?
And we'd take the guys ashore with us, and we'd go to the Merchant Seaman's Club and take these guys. And when we got back to New York Harbor, the Navy kids that were on the ship wanted to take us to the Navy Club in New York. There were two kids and two of us, and two merchant seamen and two Navy men. We went down, and they tried to take me in the club, and they wouldn't let me in. And the two kids with me got bent out of shape and got in an argument with the shore patrol, and they arrested them and got into a fight with them and all that. So we just told them to say, "Hey, forget it, we'll just go and we'll go away." They wouldn't do it, and they wound up going to Leavenworth, I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but it was only... We just left there, and then that's when I came back to California. I think I was probably the first guy that was ever thrown off a bus in Georgia. Rosa Parks was it. She was thrown off for setting where she wasn't supposed to set.
Yeah.
And I went back. I always, on a bus or something, I always went back to the back of the bus. And I'd sit on that back seat, and the driver stopped the bus and told me to get back up in the front. And I said, "I like it here." And they threw me off the bus.
What were you doing in Georgia?
We were on our way home to California. We just came back that way, and one of the guys had a car, and he drove us back.
Because you were white, and you sat in the back of the bus that was reserved for African-Americans.
That's right. It was funny. The two guys, one of the passengers and the bus driver, threw me off the bus.
And you had no idea why or what was going on?
You know, I asked, and they told me, "Can't sit in the back of the bus."
Because out here in Los Angeles, you hadn't experienced anything like that.
No, nothing at all. You know, we were all just kids. I ran around with black kids and Mexican kids, anybody that was a friend, you know.
Yeah.
You never thought about that here mm-hmm. in those days.
Did you have any Japanese-American friends in school, classmates?
Yeah, I did have Willie Hayashi. And Willie was all of a sudden disappeared. He took his whole family. They had a flower business down in El Sereno, and they took his whole family and put them in the detention homes.
Was that hard for you to understand why?
Yeah, it was, because I couldn't understand why they do that. They were Americans.
Yeah.
And I just, after the war, I was working out. I went to, they told me that I'd never walk again when I got wounded. I shattered both bones and both legs, and I had... Doctor said I had so many wounds I couldn't close all of them. And a field surgeon, he said, "We've got to take your legs off, son." And I said, "No." you just roll me over there and let me die because I don't want to lose my legs. He thought a minute. He said, we'll see what we can do. And he promised that he wouldn't take my legs off. They put me to sleep, and I woke up, and I had casts on up to here all the way down my legs, and my wounds were all somewhat sealed up. He asked me, how am I doing? And I said, I worked in a hospital one time, I said, when I was 13, I think. And I said, I never saw red casts before. And he laughed, and he said, you had so many wounds, we couldn't close all of them. I was in the Navy hospital all the way back, and I had nine surgeons telling me. Nine surgeons worked on me from Okinawa back all the way to the United States. And every one of them told me I'd never walk again. They were trying to figure out a way to get rid of me. And so I noticed that my discharge from the Coast Guard, I was in the Coast Guard and the Maritime Service at the same time. On my discharge, it read the date I was wounded in the Navy hospital was, I liked it there, in the one on Oak Knoll Naval.
Yeah.
And a nurse came in, she was the head nurse, and she had tears in her eyes, and she said, we've got to move you out of here, Lenny. They say that you're not in the armed services. I said, I'm not, because I always thought I was. They sent me to a public health service hospital. I spent the next 3 months, I think, there, and then I asked to get out of the hospital because they were giving me codeine, which I found out later that I was allergic to, and morphine. They were pumping morphine in me. And I asked to get out of the hospital, and the doctor said, if you can get on crutches, I'll let you go. Because the Blakes came to see me, and their son was one of the boys killed on the ship. They wanted me to come and live with them. And I told them, if I can get out of the hospital, I'll come live with you. Finally, the doctor let me go, and I had got the crutches, and I got it. One of the nurses took me to the train station, sent me back, and I went to live with the Blakes. They took me in, and they were like a mother and father to me, and they finally adopted me.
It's time for our first break, and if you're listening, you may be feeling like I am, that we need to find the rewind button and go back with Leonard Blake to 1945 to understand some of the details about what happened in that kamikaze attack aboard the merchant vessel SS Mary Ann Livermore. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for photos of the ship, of Leonard, even a short video with Mr. Blake demonstrating the extent of the injuries he suffered as a 16-year-old. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck, 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 92-year-old, soon-to-be 93-year-old, Leonard Blake of Whittier, California. Orphaned as a baby, adopted by a police officer who later walked out on the family, Leonard quit school at age 13. He found any job he could, even leaving his native Southern California to work in the Kaiser shipyards in Northern California in Richmond in the Bay Area. He tried multiple times to get into the Navy or the Marine Corps, denied each time because he was simply too young. Finally, at age 15, he made it into the U.S. Merchant Marine, even though 15 was too young for that duty as well. He spent some time on the SS John Constantine, becoming aware of the inherent danger of what he was doing. After all, one out of every 26 merchant mariners, nearly 4%, died during World War II. The second ship he served aboard was the SS Mary Ann Livermore. And what were your duties aboard the Livermore?
Yeah, the hot shell man on the 350 forward.
So if there were incoming aircraft...
Yeah, I was in my forecastle at the time the plane hit us, and the armor-piercing bomb came through below decks and killed the captain and the first mate and landed next to me and exploded.
Well, and even before that, had you guys dealt with kamikazes there at Okinawa?
Yeah, we were there for 20 days.
So,
and they'd come in every day. The kamikazes would come in and they'd be hitting the ships and skipping off the water when they'd blow them up.
So you'd seen all this with your own eyes.
Uh-huh.
Did you think it was going to happen to your ship?
Well, there was always that chance.
Mm-hmm.
And we always thought we got to our gun station as quickly as we could, you know. On this one, I was down in my forecastle. I heard the plane hit. Then the bomb, when it got to me, I was on my feet. I was headed for the door, and the bomb exploded about 10 feet away from me, I guess, and killed the kid next to me. Blew me through the door into the passageway and my head first into the bulkhead. This top of my head is like a road map where I hit the bulkhead. And I woke up in a passageway sitting there in a pool of blood. And I couldn't figure out what the heck happened. I thought I was dying. I started making promises. I said, if you let me live, I'll never, and I couldn't think of anything I'd ever done because I never smoked or drank. And I made the promise that I'd never smoke or drink. And I just went from there on.
And as you described that, how close the bomb landed to you, what happened to others who were there?
It killed a kid next to me, and 11 were killed from the bomb blast and from the plane hitting the topside. 11 dead, 7 were wounded.
And it sounds almost impossible that you did survive.
Yeah.
Did you lose consciousness?
When I hit the bulkhead, I was out, yeah. It blew me through there was an escape panel on the door panel, and I was just a few feet from the door and to get into the passageway so I could get to my gun station. When it blew me through it, well, I went head first right into the bulkhead on the other side, and it put me out. I woke up sitting there looking, and I was in a pool of blood, and my legs were hanging there.
Your pants had been blown off.
That's all I had. Didn't have a shirt on.
And so you're taking stock of your injuries.
Yeah, I was looking at them.
So your legs, you couldn't control, and the muscles were detached?
They were all torn up. The calf muscle was hanging out and jumping around and blew off a portion of this foot, my left foot. And then my right foot had a great big hole on the top of my foot, and my Achilles tendon was severed, and I had all wounds everywhere. I had right here in my chest. And I remember reaching down. It was a piece of metal sticking in me here. And I reached down and I pulled it out and dropped it on the deck.
Right from the center of your chest?
Yeah.
And your eye socket was broken too?
Yeah. The socket on this side is busted here. And I don't know what was done on top because they didn't even pay any attention to my head when I got to the field hospital. When they took me off the ship, they put me in a longboat and took me over to another ship. And then put me back on the ship again, or on the longboat. And I was on the boat with the ensign that was in charge of the gun crew on my ship. And he was lying there next to me, and he was crying and apologizing. He says, I thought it was a kingfisher. I ordered the gun crew not to fire. And I said, don't blame yourself for it. That's just something that could happen to everybody. But he was all upset about it.
Because he had thought this is an American plane.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But it turns out it's a Japanese kamikaze.
Yeah.
And your body is shattered.
Yeah, everything. I had wounds everywhere. They said I had so many wounds I couldn't close all of them.
And you must have lost a ton of blood.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They were pumping blood into me all the time.
So what were you really thinking? As I try to put myself in your shoes, it's hard to imagine that you could see much of a future for yourself in that condition.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you just think, oh, this is, the end. But you just keep going.
And you mentioned that 11 of your shipmates were killed.
Yeah, and I made a promise to them. I promised them that I'd give them 10 years of my life, each one of them. I don't know how old be? Probably 110. But I keep thinking now, with this thing here, the way things are, and my heart's going on me and everything. And I look up and I say, I'm keeping me here because I made that dumb promise when I was a kid.
Well, let me ask you about that too, because I've talked to a lot of veterans who made promises like that.
Yeah.
And some of them, it was something that came from a real deep-rooted place that they really believed someone was listening when they made that promise, and others, yeah, it was a desperate, plea to someone they weren't sure was there or not. Yeah. What about for you? Is that something that you really felt deeply someone was listening to you?
Yeah, I never believed in God or anything before, but all of a sudden somebody was there, and I was thanking them for letting me live and my promises I made.
And those guys who were killed?
Yeah.
How many of them did you know well?
Probably half of them. Some of the Navy kids were around with them, and the kids in the Merchant Marine, I knew them. Bob Blake was one, and T.J. Garner was another. He was the one that was next to me. He was laying next to me on his bunk. I was sitting there in this pool of blood, and I looked over, and here comes Garner through the escape hatch. He's crawling through like this, and he's reaching out to me, and I'm thinking, I can't help him. And he was trying, just like asking for help. And I looked over at him, and he fell forward, and he had a hole in his back about that big.
6 inches or so.
Yeah, and he was dead. But
wow.
It's hard for a 16-year-old kid to go through that.
Boy, it seems impossible for a 16-year-old kid to go through that.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Bob Blake, and it sounds like there was a pretty special connection the two of you had.
Yeah, we were buddies, His mom and dad were, he was an only son too. And so when I didn't have any place to go from the hospital because the little lady that was my mother at the time, she was being taken care of by relatives. So I had no place to go. And the Blakes took me in and were very, I didn't ask anybody for any help, the government or anybody. After that, when they kicked me out of the hospital, when I went out of the hospital, I had orders to go to a public health service hospital in Los Angeles at the federal building for treatment for my injuries. When I got in there, I was on a gurney. Two doctors walked up. I guess they were doctors. And one of them steps back and he says, I don't have any sympathy for these guys in the Merchant Marine. They're just a bunch of draft dodgers.
Wow.
But I found out later that there were two news reporters, Walter Winchell and another guy, Pegler was the guy's name, were spreading rumors about the Merchant Seamen that weren't true.
And here you'd lied about your age to get in because you wanted to serve.
Yeah.
Well, and so specifically with Blake, while we're on that topic, so Bob Blake, you two were very tight. His family took you in afterwards. But what happened to him that day aboard your ship?
He was killed.
Where was he when it
hit? He was on the gun watch. He was on the 20-millimeter up on topside, and the plane killed him.
And when did you find that out, what had happened to him?
Right afterwards.
Right after you were hurt?
Yeah, I was told by the doctor that, there was 11 that were killed on my ship.
What date was that this happened?
May 28th, 1945. And that's the date I was discharged from the Coast Guard. And then my discharge from the United States Maritime Service was in 1946.
So you're 16 years old.
Yeah.
By any realistic expectation, the injuries you suffered could have or should have been enough to kill you.
Yeah, they would have been.
Your best friend is killed.
Yeah.
And several other of the guys that you'd been spending time with are killed.
Yeah.
What does that do to a 16-year-old's heart and soul and mind?
You just dream about them every night, every day. To this day, I still think of my shipmates. And they said I didn't want anything from the government at all, but they took the veteran status away from us and the GI Bill and everything. You didn't have anything. And in 1988, I found out that they did. They had rectified it, and they were veterans finally.
Yeah.
And I said, I still don't want anything to do with them. And finally, my doctor, who was an old field surgeon, Frank Rogers, he was here in Whittier. And Frank and I used to sit around and shoot the breeze about everything, the war and whatever. And he finally talked me into going to the DAV or the VA and making a claim That was in 1990-something. I finally gave in and went, you know, to the VA, and they were wanted me to take an examination. So I said, it's all right. They can look at me. And I was still had wounds that were open. I think two of them finally closed in 2010. And I sat on a table with my pants off, and this fellow walked in, and he didn't say anything. You know, most doctors will walk in, they'll say, I'm Dr. So-and-so. How you doing? And
yeah.
This guy didn't say anything. He just looked at me and had a pad in his hand. And he says, let me see your left leg, just like that. And I says, you want to look at my right leg, too? And he says, what for? I said, well, I got wounds there, too. And he looked at me and never touched me with a rowel or do anything to examine me at all. He just stood there 5 feet away from me. I started to tell him about the top of my head. You know, it was all torn up. He said, I don't want you to talk. Can't you see I'm writing? He says, let me see you walk across the room without my shoes on or anything. Well, I sort of waddle, you know. You still use the canes. And he says, why do you walk like that? And I was just about ready to reach over and grab him and pick him up and bounce him up and down. He says, you're through. That was it. I just didn't have anything more to do. The VA gave me an award of zero. Your wounds weren't serious enough to warrant any compensation. And Frank Rogers got all bent out of shape when I told him. He wrote him letters and sent him pictures of my legs with the wounds that were still there. And next thing I know, well, I've got 40% disability rate. That's what I've got with the VA.
Uh-huh.
And every doctor that's ever examined me said you should have gotten 100% disability rating.
Well, it's hard for me to imagine anything less than 100% when we consider what happened to you.
Yeah.
May 28th of 45. And I'm wondering, as you're that 16-year-old, and you say you're making promises to God and all that, but can you help us understand how much pain you were in?
I don't know if I felt the pain.
You're in shock?
In shock, yeah.
But for 76 years since then,
I've been in pain ever since.
Every day?
Every day. Yeah, I've got pain that runs from my, just below my hips, down on my legs, down through my knees, down into my feet. And I always lay there with, you know, all that pain all the time.
And so after this kamikaze attack on your ship, you end up in the hospital, hospital in Okinawa, hospital on Guam, hospital in Hawaii. And at one point, the doctors said, we need to amputate. They wanted to take your legs.
That was in the field surgeon said that.
And you just said?
No. And I made him promise. He says, don't worry, we'll see what we can do, son. And I says, you swear to God that you won't take my legs off. He says, yeah. He said, let him put me to sleep. And they operated on me and closed the wounds, I guess, as best they could. And when I got to, I was on Guam, I think, transferred me to Guam, and a nurse noticed the top of my head was always packed with blood, and she washed my hair out and cut my hair and cleaned it up. But I've always had a headache ever since, you know, it's always had a tightness in my head.
And they told you at the time, you'll never walk again?
Yeah.
Was that something one person said or that a lot of people said over and over again?
Most every doctor that operated on me told me that.
How many surgeries did you have?
I think 9.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But they tell you, you're not in the armed forces anymore.
Yeah.
And so we're not going to take care of you.
Yeah, that's right. They kicked me out.
And, you know, another thing that comes to mind, and I want to be sensitive to what you've gone through, and if there's something you don't want to talk about, you know, please tell me.
Yeah.
But I've talked to so many veterans who've been wounded in ways that we can see and also in ways that we can't see.
Yeah.
And when you go through something that traumatic, something tells me you may relive that experience mentally in your mind.
Yeah, you do. You dream about those kids that got killed. And you never forget them. You say good morning to them every morning.
Is that something that still happens to you?
Yeah.
Wow.
Every day.
It's time for another break, but there's much more to come with 92-year-old Merchant Marine veteran Leonard Blake of Whittier, California. What did it mean to try to carry out that promise a 16-year-old made on May 28, 1945? You know, that ship, the SS Mary Ann Livermore, had Navy personnel on board serving as an armed guard. The Navy sailors who were wounded that day received Purple Hearts. The merchant mariners who helped man some of the very same guns did not. You think it should stay that way? Well, we're going to hear some of Mr. Blake's thoughts about that when we come back. And if that's something you'd like to see happen, for him to get a Purple Heart, there is an online petition in support of that. I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Also accessible there, as well as on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, are photos of the aftermath, some of the damage aboard the SS Mary Ann Livermore after that kamikaze attack. We're going to hear the rest of this resilient veteran story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation this week with 92-year-old Leonard Blake. He and his wife Gloria have made Whittier, California their home for decades, but in May of 1945, his floating home was the merchant vessel SS Mary Ann Livermore. On May 28, 1945, the Livermore became one of the last casualties of Operation Tengo, the last Japanese naval offensive of World War II. Navy records state that a twin-float single-engine biplane known as an ALF crashed into the Livermore. 11 men were killed, including some of Leonard's best friends.
And when you told us, you know, you made that promise, I'll never smoke or drink, and you also promised those guys who died that you would live 10 years for each of them.
Yeah.
What does that mean? What does it mean to live 10 years for someone? How do you live that out?
I just live my life and live a good life for them. I got jobs that I never would have gotten, you know, because of the wounds. All the wounds are still there. And I'd go in for a physical. I had a Harley. I hated cops with a passion because of that old man that left us. I used to get stopped every now and then. And I remember I was on my bike one day and I was down in Hollywood and I had the bars and risers and all the stuff to go with it. I made a left turn in front of two officers that were on motorcycles and I made a left turn on purpose in front of them. They pulled me over and I was big and bad then. I weighed 190, and I'd been working out for 9 years, I guess, and challenged this police officer to a fight. He said, "You know what?" He says, "Kid, you're never going to beat us. You better join us." And I just listened to him for some reason, and I went back to, I was working in a trucking firm, driving a truck, and I said, that's what I'm going to do. And I went out and started taking exams for all the cities, and I went to work for Linwood and became a road motors for them. And I finally left there and went to work for the county and became a deputy. Later on, well, I transferred over to the DA's office as an investigator.
So you worked for Linwood Police Department and L.A. County Sheriff's?
L.A. County Marshal's Office.
Uh-huh.
And then transferred over to the,
the district attorney.
District attorney's office, yeah.
And I know we're bouncing around here, but I want to understand, because for you it's a long time ago and you've dealt with the pain every day, so some of these elements of your story probably don't seem like a big deal to you, but they probably are to us. So all these doctors are telling you you're never going to walk again.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, because you've been in a cast, been immobilized, I'm sure you're dealing with atrophy, you're losing weight.
Yeah.
So you went from
90. I weighed 90 pounds. I weighed 160 when I was wounded, and I weighed 90 pounds when I left the hospital.
What did you have to do to get out of the hospital?
I begged the doctor to let me go. He said, "I'll let you go if you can get on crutches." And I said, "Give me the crutches." And I got the crutches, and they finally let me go. And one of the nurses took me to this train station, and I came back to Southern California to the Blakes. They were over living off of Western Avenue. And they took me in.
So this is, the family of your best friend who's killed the day you're almost killed.
Yeah.
And they visit you in the hospital and they say, "We want to adopt you."
Yeah.
How big a difference did that make in your life?
I don't know. They were the nicest people in the world. And I always thought about Bob. I owed it to him, So that's how I came to be with him.
So you go from a teenager whose body is shattered to the point they can't even close up all your wounds. You're told you're never going to walk again. You fight to keep your legs. You fight to learn how to walk.
Yeah.
And eventually you end up with a career in law enforcement.
Yeah, I got a membership to Vic Tanney's gym over in Alhambra. And I worked out at Tanney's gym for 9 years, I guess. And finally, what the heck? I think I had 18-inch arms and 52-inch chest, and my legs weren't very much. They were kind of screwed, but my upper body was great. I just went through a lot of pain from it, but it's memories, a lot of it.
What drove you that whole time to do all this? Why didn't you give up?
I just owed it to my shipmates that I'd try and do the best I could. I still see them when I wake up in the morning. Somebody kept telling me, "Go to the VA, file for more money." And I said, I finally gave in. And that's when my legs were still shot. But I thought, well, I'll go back and see if they give me what I should have. Then the disabled veterans wanted me to file a case. And I said, "Okay, go ahead and do it." And the guy says, "We're going to file for PTSD. And I said, "What's that?" And they said, "We're going to file for that." I said, "Well, I'd rather just have you file for my legs." But they filed for the PTSD. They came back with, "Well, because you won't admit that you'll commit suicide, well, that doesn't work. Why would I commit suicide when I made a promise that I was going to live for these guys?" And they just can't understand it, I guess. I don't know.
And is it true that you've never received the Purple Heart?
No, never got it. I filed for it. People tried to get it for me, and no Purple Heart. I've got a list of 24 men that were given the Purple Heart that were in the Marching Band. They gave the Purple Heart to newspaper men.
Ernie Pyle?
Yeah, Ernie Pyle, yeah.
Does that bother you?
Yeah. They gave us the Mariner's Medal, is what they called it.
And there's no disputing what happened to you?
No.
And as you said, in 1988, the Merchant Marine was granted veteran status.
Yeah.
So there doesn't seem to be any logical reason to deny you the Purple Heart.
No, it wasn't, but they just don't do it.
What would it mean to you if somehow, some way, you were awarded the Purple Heart?
I'd really appreciate it very much, because I'd take the Purple Heart for those that were killed.
The injuries that you suffered 76 years ago.
Yeah.
How do they still affect you today?
Pain. It doesn't quite. The doctor said you've got so much nerve damage that you're never going to walk again. And I said, no, I'm going to walk. And I got up. It took me 2.5 years to get off crutches and canes. So I walked with canes for a while. And then finally I got big and strong enough to, when I'd go in for a physical exam, most of the doctors in those days were doctors that were field surgeons and doctors from World War II. And they'd look at me and they'd say, what happened to you? And I'd tell them, and they'd say, yep, you passed. So I got my physical exams most of the time, but my hearing was gone too. I got a hearing aids, but it doesn't do much good.
Just listening to, you know, what you've had to endure for all this time since you're a teenager, have you ever felt like people didn't believe you? That somehow they questioned what had happened to you?
Yeah, I thought of that. But it's not they ignore you, you know, it's like this one doctor they sent me to. But every doctor that's ever examined me has told me that you deserve a lot more than that. They say no.
There were 406,000 Americans who died while serving in World War II. Including 11 of your shipmates who you dedicated the rest of your life to.
Yeah. Well, they lost more men percentage-wise than any of the armed services, but nobody publicized it at all.
The Merchant Marine. Yeah. You know, for those of us who didn't experience this, certainly the way you did, and for many of us right now listening, we didn't even live through this time in our history. Why is it important to remember those who died, those friends of yours and 406,000 more?
Should never be forgotten. They gave their lives and their ability to function, and they should never be forgotten.
What's your life like now, and what keeps you going?
This little girl I married 65 years ago. Poor thing, she really got herself into it.
How did you two meet?
I was in East L.A. College, and I ran into her. I met her before. She'd been going with a friend of mine, and I met her, and we finally got together. Got married.
You guys have children?
Yeah, two, a boy and a girl.
And how many grandkids?
Two grandkids.
Any great grandkids?
Not yet.
Well, that's four people who wouldn't be here if you didn't survive that day.
Yeah.
Well, there's a few things. Number one, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you. If there's anything else you want to share, I hope you feel free to share it. I don't want to forget to say thank you.
Yeah, I just don't want to see them forget those that died during the wars.
Yeah, and I want to say on behalf of everybody who's listening, I want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for your example of perseverance and your determination to honor those shipmates. Yeah. Is there something when you look back over 92 plus years, is there something you'd say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
That I live for them. I'm glad I can do it.
And is there anything that you're looking forward to that hasn't happened yet that you'd really like to see happen?
Yeah, a one-story house.
So you don't have to climb the stairs on crutches?
Yeah, I crawl up the stairs every night.
Oh, man. What do you think, you know, for those of us who didn't live through World War II, what do you think is important for us to know and understand and remember about what happened then?
Just that all those men that were March Marine and in a class with all the rest of them, and the same, they sacrificed their lives for this country.
How do you view your own sacrifice? What's your perspective on that?
Just pain. Just a lot of pain, mentally and physically, because you dream about those boys that died and all of them that died in World War II.
Well, I guess I should ask you in light of that, too, and I'm not trying to put thoughts in your head. I'm just curious what's really there, how you really see it, because you said, you know, you made these promises to God.
Yeah, that's it.
Have you done on keeping those promises?
Yeah.
You have?
I hope so. I'll never forget them.
What do you think happens next?
I don't know. I just keep looking up. You're keeping me here.
Yeah, why do you think he's keeping you here?
Because I made a promise. A promise I'd live for those guys.
Well, more people are going to know about those guys because you had the courage to share this with us today.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Well, you know, some of these questions may seem odd, but I'm just wondering because you've lived the last 76 years with your life dedicated to those men who died on your ship. Is there something the rest of us can do to ensure that their sacrifice and your own sacrifice doesn't go to waste? What do you think is the best thing we can do to honor that sacrifice?
Just remember them. Remember those that have gone before us, that died for us.
And what's your view of what they died for?
For their country, and the love of their country.
Well, thank you for opening your heart today, sir. I really appreciate you sharing.
All right.
Is there anything else you wanted to say?
I guess not, except thank you.
Leonard Blake, 92 years old, still keeping those promises and still hopeful that maybe someday he'll receive that Purple Heart. If that is something you believe should happen, I have the petition linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. You can also find that short video there of Mr. Blake outlining the extensive injuries he suffered 76 years ago. And you can see photographic evidence of the shape his ship was in after that kamikaze attack. Big thanks to Sheila Sova of the American Merchant Marine Veteran Organization for letting me know about Mr. Blake and his story. And before we go, here's one more thing he can look forward to, and we can all look forward to celebrating with him. In 2019, California Congressman John Garamendi sponsored a bill to award the Congressional Gold Medal to all Merchant Marine veterans of World War II. In 2020, President Donald Trump signed that into law, so the U.S. Mint will be designing that medal, and hopefully Merchant Mariners won't have to wait too long to hold it in their hands. Maybe, with your help, Leonard Blake will have a Purple Heart to display right alongside of it. That's all the time we have on the radio today. Don't forget, you can access the podcast version of this episode or any of our previous episodes at hometownheroesradio.com. Thank you so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you one more time of that simple truth that Leonard Blake's 76 years of physical and emotional pain underscores so powerfully. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.